welcome to the conversation Peter Mantis, General Partner of Logos LP based in Toronto, Canada. Peter, it's great to have you here, and I look forward to learning about your investment approach. Perhaps we could get started with a little bit of background on yourself and the genesis of your firm, please.
Sure. I'm originally from Ottawa, Canada, and I went to business school there at the University of Ottawa. And I met my partner, who's also a general partner, Matthew, at McGill, where we did our post-secondary education, where I went to McGill for law school and he went to McGill as well. And I had done a lot of research on academic research and just general research as well on how portfolio construction can optimize performance as well as on the multiple ways to value companies bottom up. And Matthew had a lot of experience internationally, and he had a particular expertise in global macro and behavioral economics. So we combined a lot of that expertise and developed a pretty unique approach to portfolio construction that we tested out as a beta prior to the inception of the fund. And given the early success, we launched Logos in March of 2014. And Matt actually came up with the word Logos. I think at the time he was reading a bunch of Greek philosophy. And so the word Logos is Greek for word or reason. And the idea of Logos in Greek harks back to the 6th century, where Heraclitus discerned that the cosmic process was a logos analogous to reasoning power in man. And so we thought it was a great name because we take an interdisciplinary outlook to value investing, which allows us to identify and evaluate businesses using equal part logic and creativity.
Terrific. Well, you've been doing it for some years now, and I'd love to get a little bit of a sense for how those years have gone, you know, whether the initial impetus for launching it has kind of played out as you expected, and where do you hope to take the firm over time?
Yeah, so we're long-term investors. Knock on wood, the first 5 years have been good. And we were fortunate enough to see a major drawdown in the fourth quarter of 2018, which we believe would provide for excess returns in at least the short to medium term. Our compounded annual return is around 15%, 15.5%. Every year we try to push out a double-digit return for our limited partners. So we anticipate, our goal at the very least is, the high double digit returns over the long term.
So let's talk a little bit about your investment approach. You alluded to the impetus for starting the firm. Is that still part of the approach?
Yeah, exactly. It is. Like our ideal investment universe is usually mid cap to small cap stocks that have long secular growth stories with high returns on capital. However, we will evaluate large caps and mega caps if we believe there's a significant mismatch between value and price in the short to medium term. And a lot of the process or my investment universe is really to generate ideas via value-based screeners that give us a list of investment ideas to evaluate a number of stocks. Sometimes, as in August 2018, sometimes nothing will come up. But ultimately, we get to a point where we talk about what kind of names are out there and create a defined list of names to evaluate further in proxy statements and annual reports. And so that's typically how we generate ideas for the fund, and is usually the starting point for our investment process.
You are based in Canada. Does Canada figure prominently in your investment universe, or do you tend to look elsewhere?
The portfolio right now is 65 US and about 35 Canadian. And so we typically are within North America. We do evaluate everything in Europe and Asia as well. There's not necessarily a bias with respect to being mostly in Canadian equity. It really is about where do we see the best value and the best companies that fit the profile of investment that we're looking for.
So let's talk a little bit more about the profile that you do look for. There's obviously a lot of different flavors of value investing. It's a pretty wide spectrum. So where would you put yourselves on that spectrum?
So for most individual funds, they'll consider value investing as looking for companies that are have a discount to their discounted cash flow, or they're doing a multiple based approach, or they do it on an earnings based approach. We consider that, but for us, the most important thing is what are the secular growth tailwinds that face a particular company, and do we think that we can attain a price that is well below what we believe the company would be worth based on those projected cash flow or current cash flows that it is spitting out. So an investment, just an example of a case study for an investment that we do like, is a company called Huntington Ingalls Industries, which is on the New York Stock Exchange. HII is the symbol. And this was spun off by from Northrop Grumman in 2011. And they are the largest shipbuilder in the United States. So if anyone is going to touch US ships, it will be HII. And this is a company where has a huge backlog, 23 billion, I believe, very high return on capital, spits out a lot of cash. And the secular growth story here is in October of 2018, the US Navy published a report proposing for one of the largest investments in US Navy ships and submarines since Reagan. So there is a massive push for the buildup of these ships and submarines, which is really needed given how much these ships have deteriorated or depreciated over time. So the company is a consistent earner, generates tons of free cash, also has an IT arm, which is hasn't really been priced in effectively in the company. They provide IT cybersecurity, IT networking, IT consulting, software, and it's an acquisitive arm. So this is a company with very long tailwinds, very high return on capital, excellent secular growth story. And in December of this past quarter, sold off so much, including and has had been selling off due to the tariffs and the trade war with Trump. But it was trading at 10 times earnings, 10 times cash flow, less than one time sales, which was well below what a normal defense stock would command with that kind of backlog and with a software business. So that is the name, a name where it's perfect size, perfect secular growth story, excellent valuation that we can just buy and hold on and wait for the market to appreciate its value.
And how do you come across an idea like this? Is that a screening or have you had it on your watch list for some time? Give us a sense of your idea generation process, please.
Sure. So as mentioned earlier, our universe is small to mid cap stocks, and so we use value-based proprietary screens to identify a list of candidates. Sometimes we'll come up with many, sometimes we'll come up with no candidates. We'll then come up with a very short list of what we believe are companies that require further evaluation. And then we'll dive deep into those names. So we'll go through proxy reports, we'll go through annual reports, we'll go through presentations, we'll call up management teams as well. And then from there, we'll come up with a list, which is effectively on our watch list. And then from there, we start to mark what exactly are pricing thresholds and also what kind of percentage do they take up in the portfolio for our portfolio construction thresholds. And once we do that, if they hit our threshold, if they hit our price targets, we enter into a position to buy.
There's a lot of talk of moats and competitive advantage. Let's take Huntington Ingalls as an example. You know, how would you judge a moat of a company like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So for a company like Huntington, it's really about the stickiness of the services, the stickiness of the products that it's making. If anyone, for example, is going to be touching U.S. ships, it's going to be Huntington, right? They're a preferred vendor for the U.S. government. They have a long history of delivering projects. They provide other services to the U.S. government. They have an expertise in that field. And with expertise and with stickiness comes pricing power. And pricing power is not just to increase prices, but also to understand that business very well. You can control the costs in your business very well as well. So Huntington is an example where there's a business with a very large moat because no one else will be able to touch U.S. ships. Their preferred vendor with the U.S. government. There's a lot of stickiness there. They have the expertise in this field, unlike other defense contractors. And that usually allows for greater pricing power and cost control. So that creates a very significant competitive advantage, despite the fact that Huntington is only a $7 billion business. It is a business with what we believe is a fairly wide moat.
So how does the pricing dynamic work in a case like this? Because it seems like on the one hand, as the dominant player, they could just raise prices. On the other hand, you basically have one customer, the U.S. government, and they could push back. So help us just understand a little bit more about the pricing power and how that I guess procurement process actually works.
Yeah. So pricing can go two ways. There's price increases, but there can also be price decreases in the sense that they can go to the US government and say, look, the typical cost for this particular ship is $2 billion. We can do it for $1 billion or $900 million. And because they have the expertise, they've had the long track record of building ships for the U.S. government forever, they're able to reduce prices for their customer, which is the U.S. government, all the while making significant amount of cash flow and profit for their business and therefore creating large shareholder returns. So in this instance, it's an excellent example where it'd be very difficult for a competitor to build ships at budgets that they provide because it just wouldn't be economical. But given their expertise, they're able to save the U.S. government a lot of money by building a lot of ships. At the same time, they also have a lot of pricing power going upwards, which is because of their innovation and technology in software, in simulation, in professional services. They're able to add more value to a lot of the ships they build and therefore add more pricing power to the deliverables that they provide to the U.S. government.
Do they also build ships for U.S. Allies? Is that a significant part of the business?
The vast majority is U.S. government. They also provide IT servicing and IT security as well to other multinationals like Boeing, ExxonMobil, or other companies that may have offshore oil sites like BP. But the vast majority is U.S. government contracting.
And are they the leader across all the various categories? You know, let's say aircraft carriers or
yes.
destroyers yep. and such.
Yeah, aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, destroyers, they are the leader in all those categories. There's also a chance to really solidify market share there because they already have such large expertise in creating the George H.W. Bush ship, the Gerald Ford, a number of large ship projects which are high profile for the U.S. Navy. They really are the ones who are responsible for those large projects going forward.
And is this the kind of investment where you just buy it at the right price and then you hold it for a very long time? I mean, to what extent do you track, things like the U.S. government budget and those kinds of developments to see whether, the position that you have, makes sense, I guess.
We definitely, given our approach, we definitely look for a good entry point on price. We certainly monitor the secular story, in this case, government spending on outdated ships, to see if that thesis has changed. However, if we believe that that hasn't drastically changed and there's still the market that it operates in is still quite solid and strong, it's a name where we would buy a significant portion in and hold for some time. Because of the profile of the business, because of the return on capital, because of the size and the story, it becomes very difficult to find many other businesses with that kind of profile that really make it worth your while. So we will take a meaningful position and develop it as almost as a core position in the portfolio that we intend to hold for a decade or more.
And I believe you mentioned that it was a spin-off. Was that part of the attraction? Do you screen spin-offs or look at them as they come to the market?
Spin-offs are interesting. We're always interested in spin-offs, mainly because a lot of times that's where you can find quite a bit of value, because current shareholders in the mothership are sometimes not interested in the spin-off. So you could, and a lot of times these spin-offs are truly uncovered, because they're not part of the greater business. So we do evaluate spin-offs. With some clarity and certainty, we do have a dedicated eye on this, but it's not the sole area that we focus on. In the case of Huntington, it just happened to have a lot of other characteristics from a quantitative and qualitative perspective that made it an attractive investment.
Maybe using Huntington as an example, help us understand how you think about position sizing and concentration in the portfolio.
So the way we structure our portfolio from a high level is we have a number of core positions, and around those corporate positions are what we like to call peripheral positions. The core positions are really names that we hold on for a very, very long time, decades or multi-decades. Huntington is an example where we take a long position in, given the very long secular tailwinds, the rarity of finding a company of that size, which is a mid-cap, with that kind of return on invested capital and a fantastic management team. Huntington is one name where it would be a core, and it would be a somewhat larger larger portion of the portfolio. So there'd be a somewhat larger concentration within the fund. Another name that we own that is a core for us is Church & Dwight, which I know many people know as Arm & Hammer baking soda and Trojan condoms. So these names, which start off as sort of mid caps, 7, 8, 9, 6, 7, 8, 9 billion market cap that we believe can become 32, 40 billion market caps, are names and beyond, obviously. Are names that we typically try to build cores around. The peripherals around the portfolio are names that we find have significant mispricings. So it could be a large cap stock that is just unfairly punished due to earnings report. It could be some secular headwinds that it's facing, but it's been beaten too much. It could be a macroeconomic story. So those will be more short term to medium terms. So 65% of the portfolio is in our top 10 names. I would say that 55% of the portfolio is encompassed through the cores and the 45% in the peripherals.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you view competitive advantage and what sources of competitive advantage you've found to be the most durable. You talked a little bit about it with Huntington, obviously, but are there patterns you've seen that have worked particularly well in the past that you tend to look for?
Yeah, we think price is pretty powerful, and price is a consequence of a more deeper competitive advantage, which is the real necessity or inelasticity for that product or service. So, so an example would be, you know, we love Church & Dwight, which is a company that that competes with Tide and Reckitt-Benckiser. This is a company with very strong brand recognition, very excellent margins, you know, fantastic management team. They've positioned their products to a science. So this is a company where over time has a lot of pricing power because they dominate their categories. They're in the right spaces with long secular tailwinds, and they have significant market share and brand recognition. So price will typically be the most durable competitive advantage, where because it impacts all levels of the business. It impacts top line growth, it impacts margins, and ultimately net profit. And companies that start to see that really have control over price and can increase price over time without having significant CapEx investments, we'll start to see their return on capital increase. And so over time, those are the companies that will really outperform and have really strong moats.
And how do you think through risks when it comes to your investments? You know, for instance, with Church & Dwight, there's a lot of talk out there on kind of the disruption that's happening in the consumer brand space and how easy it's become to launch new brands or market them on Amazon or in various ways of business models. You know, how do you think of that kind of long-term threat, and how do you assess that?
Right. So we see risk and prospective low returns as the two sides of the same coin. And so when we evaluate any kind of business, we always look at what potential downside threats can attack this company's moat. In the case of Church & Dwight, we believe it's less exposed to a lot of the disruption that's being faced by the Procter Gambles of the world or other companies that are in the middle of the grocery aisle. Church & Dwight is in a very unique position where they straddle on the verge of personal care to healthcare. And because they dominate such niche brands or such niche markets, with very little competition, there's very little private label exposure. They have a tremendous track record of growth through their e-commerce channel. They have tremendous track record of acquisitions. It's a case where not necessarily we're afraid of disruption from a brand perspective, but we're afraid, or what the risk that we would evaluate is, would the company get too ahead of itself? Would it make the wrong acquisition? Will one of its acquisitions not integrate very well within the markets that it's looking towards? So these are the kinds of risks that we would see in a stock like Church & Dwight. But to answer your question as to how we see risk for any particular stock, we would look, well, what does the future look like for a company like Church & Dwight or like Huntington? What is the story still intact, and can it still maintain the return on invested capital that it's enjoyed for the last 20, 30 years? If the answer to that question is no, without certainty or some certainty, then we see it as a risky investment and cannot make a purchase.
You talked about the management team at Church & Dwight as being superb. Help us understand how you assess that.
Right. So we look at management teams that have a number of qualitative characteristics. First being, is there a large amount of insider ownership? Second is, do they have a fairly clean proxy statement? I don't like to see companies with a lot of related party transactions. Do they are they transparent in their communication? Are they focused on total TSR, total shareholder returns? So these are the kinds of companies that, or management teams rather, that I enjoy on our companies to have. So in the case of Church & Dwight, you have a management team that has really grown organically. They all have a healthy insider ownership mentality. They're transparent with their shareholders, focused on total shareholder returns, very patient when it comes to acquisitions, and their strategy is very clear. And they understand their businesses very well. So these are the kinds of management teams where I don't really have to sleep at night. And the culture that is within Church & Dwight is one that we look for other companies.
And when it comes to the incentives of management, do you have things you look for there, either in terms of how the compensation is structured or how much equity the management team owns?
We do look for compensation that it does link to performance. We do prefer that. In the case of Church & Dwight, they link a lot of their performance to gross margin, which is actually a leading indicator of outperformance for a number of companies. There's actually a recent academic paper that talks about how gross margin can be the most leading indicator for company total shareholder return, more so than any other metric. So we do like to see, fairly paid executive teams with an incentive structure that does match company performance.
I'd be curious whether you could talk about some CEOs whom you particularly admire or are either invested alongside currently or would like to be invested alongside at the right opportunity.
So Matt Farrell at Church & Dwight, I greatly admire. So I'll actually break it down. So current CEOs, Matt Farrell at Church & Dwight, Stanley Ma at MTY Food Group. So he's CEO of a franchise operator. Olivier Filliol at Mettler-Toledo, another great CEO. Of course, Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway. From past CEOs, really admire Henry Singleton at Teledyne. He was really reclusive, had decentralized operations, repurchased shares like nobody else. So those are the kinds of CEOs that we admire from past and present.
And there are also a couple of approaches among value investors when it comes to talking to management teams. Some like to avoid it completely to not be biased, and others seek out the dialogue. What's your take on that? And is that part of your process to engage with management?
We typically don't talk to CEOs too much. We find CEOs are great salesmen, and so they can certainly pitch their stock. And we like to evaluate the business from a detached and impersonal way without having any bias. Having said that, we do at times seek dialogue with management teams of smaller companies or companies that have significant insider ownership or they're family owned, where there's not a lot of float. Or if we think that the company requires a little bit of a clarification on strategy. With respect to activist investing, we believe it can be useful in creating greater shareholder value because there are many companies with terrible management teams, but we typically do not ride shotgun on such adventures. There are enough high quality businesses for us to choose from out there, and we'd rather build significant stakes in those kinds of businesses with solid management teams than deal with factors that are outside our control.
How do you think about the art of valuing a business? What considerations do you make there? And, you know, are there any metrics that stand out in particular in terms of being important to your valuation approach?
Yeah, so I mean, I think for many value investors, they may overemphasize traditional metrics that may typically provide for what a value investment ought to look like. And so we take the view that multiples or industry comparables need to be taken with a grain of salt. So although investing is highly quantitative, a portion of the analysis is qualitative and should assist in quantitative valuation. So for example, if you take a high growth mission critical enterprise software company, and you know, it will have a price to book that may be quite high. And even compared to other software companies, it may look even higher than normal. If you look at a utility company, if you look price to book, for example, it may be quite low. And so someone might say, well, utility company might be cheaper than a software company, or this particular software company is more expensive than another particular software company. The problem is that for a utility, for example, we know what the book value is. We see the plants and property equipment. We see the debts and assets. We see the inventory. We see it all. For a company, for this, for a mission critical software company, there's a lot of things that are not seen on the balance sheet. So for example, knowledge and processes created by investments in R&D and innovation. So although R&D, for example, may be an expense on the income statement, we know intuitively that there's lasting value on the balance sheet through knowledge transfer, through innovation, through processes that can be repeated, reproduced, and improved over and over and over again. So for a particular software company, we can say if we actually quantified what is the value of that knowledge or that R&D that may come down the line, we may say that it's actually cheaper than other software companies that have higher, that have lower price to book values, or the utility company. So there's a little bit of understanding the business, thinking critically about the qualitative aspects of the business. There's a little bit about understanding the secular growth story for the business that is in the sort of art of value investing. We also like to evaluate from taking away the art, how can we merge the art that we can sort of the qualitative aspect of that art to eventually being translated into earnings and cash flow. So free cash flow is obviously a major input to our calculations, and understanding what earnings mean and how they will look like going forward. So we're interested in definitely diving deep into those kinds of businesses. And if businesses can grow free cash flow over time, or we believe they can grow, and if free cash flow becomes a greater percentage of sales while CapEx does not, then those are the kinds of businesses that we'd be more interested in.
Obviously, there are cycles to the market, if you will. Howard Marx's new book talks about that. Mm-hmm. Help us understand to what extent you are fully invested versus having cash in the portfolio. at different times, or do you vary the cash position consciously? How is that, how does that work?
We always effectively remain fully invested in the market, especially with our core positions. We will have times where we have greater than usual cash positions in certain times of the market. So, for example, in August of 2018, this past the Q4 of 2018, we had larger than usual cash position, and so we were very fortunate because we used that cash in making strategic purchases, particularly in December of this past of 2018. So we will evaluate market cycle to see, where are we in this particular cycle and how much cash should we have, or whether we should lighten up on a particular position or not. But give or take, we're always effectively fully, or not fully, but we're always invested, especially within our core positions.
And you talked about concentration in the portfolio to some extent. Anything else that you kind of keep in mind on that front? What about industries? Do you have particular focus in terms of industries or industries that you prefer? And to what extent do you keep the portfolio diversified across sectors?
So the industry and the sector will come into an evaluation of how much of the portfolio we make up of this company. So, for example, if you take a company like CGI, which is another company we really like, they have a massive total addressable market in the trillions. So the company's worth $23 billion, huge backlog. It's clear that this is a $100 billion company in the next decade. So sometimes you can look at size and you can look at market and say, okay, this is a company that you can take a you can have a larger position in. If you take a company like Huntington, it is, by our estimates, the company is worth north of 20 to $21 billion. So and that's the fact of the story, the industry, the cycle that we're in for this kind of business. And so, okay, we will have a somewhat larger position in the fund. Church & Dwight has a massive market and has also markets that are ha haven't been fully priced in yet, right? Not many people know, or maybe some analysts know, that Church & Dwight has a very large animal business, or it will be a large animal business. Animal productivity. Humans are consuming resources faster than they're replacing them. And so animal productivity is going to be a real story for the population over the next 30, 40 years. So that is an example of a business where not only do we have the consumer, which is in the trillions of dollars, but we also have markets that are being operated in there that is it is attacking that could have very large growth attached to it. So we do look at the particular market they operate in. We do look at the industry that the company's in. We do look at its positioning and strategy. That those all come into play when looking at the kind of concentration that we want for any particular stock.
If I can just come back to CGI for a moment, you mentioned recently 23 billion market cap, but it could be up to 100 billion over time. How do you think about that opportunity, and why do you believe CGI will continue to outperform?
Well, CGI has a very as a luxury or privilege of operating in effectively an oligopoly. Not only are they consulting large governments and multinationals, but they're actually getting into developing software. So their largest competitor is right now Accenture, which already is in the $100 billion business plus. CGI has an ever-growing backlog of contracts for their services and technology, and the market that they operate in is north of a trillion. And it has only captured a very, very small percentage of that total addressable market. So with the strategy that the company has, the demand for IT services, the growth rate for IT services, this is all fairly known. It is calculable or is quite, one can see how the company over 10, 15 years, 20 years even, can reach $100 billion, or probably sooner, probably within the next 10, 15 years. Given its high return on capital, and given its very shareholder-friendly policy, we can see how the value of the company can be supported towards that that valuation. So that's an example of a company that happens to be in, again, very strong secular growth story, excellent tailwinds, very interesting industry that has a very large spend, and effectively operates in an oligopoly. So all of those allow us to qualitatively analyze the business and say, okay, we can see how we can have a path to, you know, 100 billion in market cap or more.
If I can ask a question on investment mistakes, we like to ask this of the folks we speak with, what would you consider to be the biggest mistake that tends to keep investors from reaching their goals?
I think the biggest mistake for investors is not understanding their self intimately, not being aware of their own human nature, and having emotion take over when making a decision. So understanding your own tics, your own insecurities, your destructive patterns. So we spend a lot of time living on the surface, reacting emotionally to what people say and do, and we're drawn to actions that stimulate our own human tendencies toward greed, instant gratification, the pursuit of pleasure. But refusing to come to terms with that basic human nature means that investor can doom themselves to patterns beyond their control, and to feelings of confusion and helplessness. So the negative investment outcomes tend to follow that. So thus, avoiding investment mistakes really means developing self-knowledge and awareness of yourself, and having the discipline, you know, to make prudent decisions in the long run.
Are there any books that you found particularly illuminating that you would recommend as providing insights into the art of investing?
The one that I really like is it's a bit of a lighter read. It's Thomas Phelps' 1972 original copy book of 100 to 1, which talks about bagger stocks, so companies where a $10,000 investment becomes $1 million. And what's fascinating about that book, there's a recent rewrite of the book that I think was published maybe 5 years ago. But the original is by far a much better read. They really dive deep into what it takes to have bagger-like returns. What I've learned through the art of value investing is how people underestimate patience in getting those kinds of returns. There are numerous, and I don't mean just 1 or 2 or 5 years. I mean waiting a long time. An example is Amazon. I mean, if you bought Amazon in 2000, I mean, you have 10 years of terrible performance. And only recently just became, you know, a mega cap. So there are many other examples in the book that talk about extreme outperformance, and how for certain positions, some investors had to wait a decade and over to see that outperformance. So I think that was a great book in my eyes to understanding how patience is really truly the one of the greatest assets an investor can have over the long run.
I'd love to understand a little bit more about your firm and kind of your long-term outlook. On your website, I found it interesting when you say that you're focused on intergenerational wealth. Tell us just a little bit about the kinds of partners or investors that you look for, and what role you hope to play in their financial life, if you will.
That's a great question. So we don't focus on having good years or couple years. We focus on having very good decades, and we're truly, truly long-term investors. And quite frankly, it's the only way that we can ever see a true snowball effect for ourselves and for our limited partners. So the typical profile of some of these investors are ones who are interested in compounding at high rates for a very long period of time. We're not interested in trading day to day, or we're not interested in having very high levels of turnover. We're not interested in picking a particular theme for any given year and then rotating in and out of that theme. We really do look for businesses where we can buy meaningful stakes in them and then compound at very high rates over decades. So the intergenerational wealth portion, a lot of our investors have that as a goal, where it's beyond for themselves. It's for long-term family wealth creation. It's for creating something that is greater than themselves. And to do that effectively, one needs to have the snowball rolling and rolling for a long time. And so those are the typical investor profile with Logos LP.
And just to understand a little bit better, how you and Matthew sort of divvy up the responsibilities. Do you both research companies, and then how does the process of actually choosing investments work?
So, like I said earlier, I do a lot of the bottom-up fundamental analysis, portfolio management. Matthew has strong expertise and experience in international development, international economics, global macro, behavioral economics. So I get a number of research reports from him pertaining to market cycles and data from Europe and what the current what the recent inversion might mean for us. So we divide the sort of investing story into two ways, where I may screen for value or find a company that is truly undervalued but may not be at the right time, or may not be in the right sort of sector or period given the macroeconomic environment, or given this our particular the particular cycle that we're in. So that's how we typically divvy up the work. And of course, we talk about every investment that's made, and we're both sounding boards for each other with respect to our own research.
Terrific. Well, Peter, this has been a great. I've enjoyed learning about what you guys are up to and your investment approach. Thank you so much for sharing your philosophy, and also for discussing those case studies that you mentioned. That was very instructive as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.